The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they're easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our Tuesday evening California time Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Great to be here. One of my favorite guests, favorite topics, X-15, plus some new topics, are on order for tonight. But before we get into tonight's program and I give you the phone numbers and things like that for the show tonight, one programming announcement, and that is that on Friday, I just want to point out to everybody that Henry Vanderbilt, who many of you know from the Space Access Society conferences in Phoenix, has important space access news and updates for us. I have no clue what they are. It's very mysterious. And he's going to be on Friday with a mystery guest. And I don't typically do mystery guests, so I honestly don't know who the mystery guest is, so even if you were going to torture me, I couldn't tell you. I could make up a name, but it might not be right. But Henry will be on, and he does say he has important space access news and updates for us with this mystery guest. So you want to hear the program live. You'll have an opportunity to talk with Henry and whoever he has on with him. So I just want to point that out to you. It'll probably be in the neighborhood of a 60-minute or so program, and that's Friday at 9:30 a.m. California time for those of you who are planning to listen to it. And then Hotel Mars, which, of course, is pre-recorded, so no telling when John will put it up. But Anatolia Zach is back with us, and we're looking into the problems of the Soyuz launch rocket last week. So that should be very timely and very interesting. For today, our toll-free number, if you would like to call and talk to our guest, Michelle Evans, 1-866-687-7223. That is the preferred way of reaching us. But you can also use email if you insist, and that is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And you can also post comments or ask questions via our blog. To do that, it is our website, thespaceshow.com, all the way over to the far right to upcoming show menu. This is the first show listed, so open it up. It's also our blog comment page. Scroll all the way down and post a comment or a question. As soon as you do that, I'll get a copy of it, and I can bring it up on air and ask Michelle or read your comment to Michelle, whichever you send. But our preferred way is the toll-free line, 1-866-687-7223, backed up by email, drspace at thespaceshow.com. And while you're at our website, again, thespaceshow.com, do check out our new website newsletter, because it not only has all of the events for this week in it, but in addition to that, it tells you what we have planned between now and the end of the year. We still have openings between now and the end of the year, but the year is going fast. If you have guest suggestions for us, please send them to me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website or rapidly download the shows because the file sizes are not very big. There is a store in the upper left under support, and we're getting close to gift-giving time, and you may find some stocking stuffer or other items there with Space Show logo wear for family members or friends that listen to the Space Show. And then Listen Live is another important button in that upper left menu. It tells you how to listen to the live shows, archive shows off of our website, and podcast shows, including those playing on Alexa. And if you have any questions about any of this, please don't hesitate to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. The most important buttons on our homepage deal with supporting the program, and We're getting ready to start our annual campaign. But remember, the Space Show is a 501c3 nonprofit with GiantLeapFoundation.org. And we are listener supported, which means we're able to do this programming because many of you do support us. And we thank you very much for that support. If you are a federal U.S. taxpayer, you do get a tax donation for your gift. And the same is true if you're a California taxpayer. So check it out. Our parent website, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, is also available for you to check out. We're going to be opening up the advisory board pretty soon, probably by the next open line show. I'll be able to give you more information about that. And if that interests you and you think you want to participate, please do let me know about that. And one other thing, we do have sponsors for our website in addition to individual support. And so the sponsors get a banner ad that goes across our website, and they can change it from time to time. And normally on full-length programs, I read a short sponsor message, both at the beginning of the first segment and the second segment. But I want to spend the time tonight talking with our guest about some really cool topics. So I want to just mention our sponsors and thank them all very much for being with us tonight. Northrop Grumman is a great sponsor, AIAA, Celestis, the Space Development Network that focuses on space settlement, National Space Society, the Space Plan, and that's by the Integrated Space Group, and the Space Foundation. And we certainly appreciate all of our sponsors. We would not be doing the show without their added support. Click on their banner ads from time to time and see what is underneath them. See what's under circle number 3. And again, thank you to those sponsors. So as I mentioned a few minutes ago, Michelle Evans is back with us. And she's been a great guest, but more than that, she has just an incredible book out there that you would never, ever, ever tire of reading and using as a reference book. The X-15 Rocket Plane, Flying the First Wings into Space, Outward Odyssey, A People's History of Spaceflight. She did this book in 2013, and it is as timely and wonderful and as exciting today as it was back then. And if you read it every day in the intervening years, I bet you still wouldn't have even a fraction of the knowledge about X-15 that Michelle has. But she is the founder and president of Mach 25 Media. She's a writer, a photographer, and a communication specialist in aerospace. In addition to her book, which we've been talking about and we'll mention again in the show, she has an aerospace engineering background, including serving in the Air Force, working on missile systems, and later in private industry, accomplishing environmental testing for systems used in airliners and spacecraft. She's a distinguished lecturer with the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, and her X-15 book has won many awards, and she's won many awards in Orange County as an Orange County leader. And on top of that, she was a technical consultant, and this is where we're going to start the show tonight, on the current First Man Neil Armstrong movie. And she can tell us a little bit about being a technical consultant on the movie and her thoughts on it. I urge you to read her full bio. It is on the Space Show website. If you have not read her book, if you don't have it, you're making a big mistake. You really need to get it and read it. And it's one of those books that you'll have on your desk as a space reference book forever and all times going forward. It is really an outstanding book. Michelle, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much, David, and I really appreciate your comments about the book. That means a lot to me.
All true, not a bit of exaggeration. And anybody who picks that book up or who has it or who has read it or even thumbed through it would be jumping up and down and saying the same thing. How did you come about getting to be a first man consultant? What's the process for that?
Well, in this case, I believe I have Andy Chaikin to thank. I got a note from Andy, and I got then a subsequent note from one of the people at the production, and they said they were looking for some some specific information about Neil and his time while he was at Edwards on the X-15. And I said, well, sure, if there's things I can help with, I'll be glad to help. And subsequently, I ended up working with him for about 3 months, again, primarily on everything to do with the time at Edwards, not with anything to do with Gemini or Apollo.
Did they film those scenes at Edwards, or was this all on the back lot with a lot of 3D graphics and things like that?
Well, the there was a scene that was filmed out near Edwards on the dry lake beds. I don't believe they were actually on the base itself at Rogers, but I think they were next door at Rosamond. That's my understanding on it. So there is a shot where Neil has landed the vehicle after Flight 3-4, and it's out on the lake bed, so they have the full-scale mock-up of the X-15 that they created, and they show it out there on the lake bed. Unfortunately, the scenes are very short. I wish they would show a lot more. The X-15 was backlit, so we basically just see it in silhouette, but that was filmed out there pretty close to where these incidents actually happened. The rest of the things that you see with the X-15 were all filmed on a soundstage, a simulator that they had set up down in Georgia. So the X-15 was flying in Georgia.
Well, it made a long trip. So
yes.
So that was like 3G graphics and things like that that they did on the soundstage and made it look real?
Well, actually what they did is really interesting. The way that it's set up was that they have this giant wraparound screen. So when you saw him, like, in the cockpit looking out the windows,
uh-huh.
or you saw the scenes looking back or forward along the X-15, that was not CGI. That was not inserted along with a model or along with the cockpit. That was actually being filmed real-time with an actual simulator of the X-15 with this giant wraparound screen that was going on at the same time that they had projected in front.
Were you there in Georgia, too?
No, I was not in Georgia, and unfortunately, I actually wasn't even invited up to the landing scene at Edwards. I was actually a bit ticked off about that because that was the one thing that I had asked for. I did not get paid for my technical consulting. I did say that the one thing I wanted to do was to be out there when they had the X-15 on the lake bed, and they fell through on that with me, and I was a bit ticked about that.
Well, I would be, too. I'd be ticked that they didn't pay me either. So.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, maybe I should have insisted on that, but it's like just seeing the X-15 on the lake bed, that would have been more than compensation enough for what I did.
What was the model made of? Was it made of wood, or what? How did they make the model?
That I have no idea. I've not been able to get any information about the mock-up that they did. I don't know if that mock-up is still in existence. If so, where it's at. I would definitely like to track it down.
Maybe you can lay claim to it somehow.
There you go. I'll take that any day, sure.
You know, I don't want to do spoilers on the film in case somebody hasn't seen it, although I imagine everybody knows how it ends and knows the story, especially since so much of the ending has been in the news. But it starts with the X-15. But, you know, if you don't know anything about this period of time or Neil or, you know, Edwards Air Force Base or X-15, you have no clue what's going on. I mean, you see him, you know, in this vehicle. You don't know what it is. You know, it doesn't look like an airplane. And there's only one mention of X-15 after he lands on the lake bed. And as I recall, there's nothing on the fuselage that says X-15, or if there was, I missed it. So there's one comment that says something about X-15 or something like that. And then the whole scene shifts to something else. And it didn't get a whole lot of time, which I thought was kind of weird. But
yeah, I really would have liked to have seen quite a bit more, and especially coming for people who were not familiar with the program, which is most of the viewing public,
yeah.
Is there was absolutely no context for what was happening. So, as you say, coming in, it was an exciting way to start the movie, but it sort of leaves the viewer like, what's going on here? And so they leave a lot to be desired as far as, you know, cluing people in on what's going on. And I was, again, the basic thing is there's a lot of good in this movie, but there's also a lot of things that I didn't like about the movie. So I'm very mixed in my review of it.
People next to me, I heard them saying, you know, talking during the movie, what is that rocket he's riding in? You know, are they testing the moon rocket? What is he doing? And when X-15 was briefly mentioned, the guy sitting next to me, he's talking to the people next to him, not to me, said, what's an X-15? So I think that's probably pretty common with most people. They don't know. And they're right. They're all young. Probably most of the people in the movie weren't born when any of this was going on. So
yeah.
they didn't see movie tone news with X-15 flights and Jaeger breaking the sound barrier and things like that. They didn't grow up with any of that stuff. So yeah, there should have been a lot more context to it.
Well, I think even one really good piece of context would have been they needed to show the X-15 in flight. And I know they sort of did, but not the way I'm talking about.
Not the way you're talking about it at all.
Yeah, because, I mean, they have these point-of-view shots. They have, like, this camera looking back along the fuselage, so you see that as you drop away from the B-52 and start heading up. And then they have the camera turned around looking toward the nose of the X-15. And, of course, you have the cockpit view, his point of view looking out the cockpit windows, and those kind of scenes. But there's never once a scene of the whole X-15 flying up into the sky or coming back through reentry. And the only shot we ever have of the entire vehicle is that shot on the lake bed after he's landed. And again, only in silhouettes. You really still don't get the full context of it.
Did you get to meet any of the actors or the crew or the director or screenwriter or any of the key people?
No, it was all done via email.
How disgusting!
as I say, there's that. I went in there trying to be helpful, and you know, I worked with actually several different people on the production. I think I provided them a lot of good information. I hope that it really helped out in those scenes, but. Yeah, there's so many other things that I wish they had asked me about that they didn't. Because, yes, there's definitely a lot of stuff, especially about the X-15, that I would have changed. But there's also things about Gemini and Apollo I would have changed, too, to make it a little bit more accurate.
Well, what was missing was so much background so that people who really don't know the story or even
right.
why we went to the moon have some framework from which to put all of this in, even the personal family scenes and the other. You didn't even know who the other astronauts were. You know, maybe
right.
people didn't even know they were other astronauts or test pilots.
Yeah.
So if you didn't know the story, if you weren't a space cadet or something, you're probably at a little bit of a disadvantage. And I'll bet not one of the people in the movie that I, when I was there, read Jim Hansen's book. I'd be really surprised. If anyone in the movie watching it had read his book, which
oh probably true yeah
you know which came out a couple of years ago, do you know if they worked with Hansen on the screenwriting or they just went off on their own?
Well, as far as I know, Hansen was involved to a certain extent, but of course the screenplay credit does go to someone else. It didn't go to Hansen, so
right.
I don't know if he had any rights of refusal or anything.
Probably
I've seen him being interviewed, and he has glowing reviews for how the thing was handled, but you know, he also has some vested interest because, of course, it's his book that they're filming, so you want to definitely put as positive a spin on it as you can. With that said, I mean, Hansen's book is great, and I really admire Hansen. What he did was wonderful. He pulled together a story that had never been done right before, and I really liked what he ended up doing. So I have very high praise for his book and for him. I just think that they handled it in the motion picture a little differently than they should have.
Well, after I saw the movie, I sent Jim a note because he's been on the show three times.
Yeah.
And I said, I just saw First Man. I didn't think very much about it. Your book is a million times better. Do you want to come back on the show and talk about your book? so he agreed to come back on the show. We're looking at dates, so he will be back on in the near future. But he didn't say anything about my comments about how I thought about the movie, and he didn't say anything about the movie from his perspective, and I didn't push him for anything like that. But I'm sure he will say something. But, yeah, he does have a vested interest. But as so often is the case, books are always better than screenplays, almost always, I should say. So I'm not surprised that we like his book a lot better than the movie. I mean, that seems to be standard. But I do think there's a lot of areas where they could have done a better job if they'd had maybe a more space knowledgeable or, you know, space sensitive screenwriter. It might have turned out differently.
Yeah, I mean, one of these things that bothers me about some of these movies is that there are so many things that could easily be fixed that would not affect the story. They would enhance the story just by simply being correct. And it really does bother me in the fact that sometimes they just want to overlook these things. I mean, there are several movies out there about the space program that screw up things. I mean, there's a lot of technical errors in something like Apollo 13, but it's a great motion picture on just about every level. But I can sit there as a space geek and sit there and say, well, yeah, but this is off or whatever. And, you know, but that's fine. I'm not going to sit there and say it's a bad movie. In this case, I think what they did with the movie, it was some interesting choices, but I think they made some wrong choices.
Well, I agree. And by the way, listeners, if any of you have seen the movie and are listening to the program and you want to give us your review, we'd be happy to hear from you, either by phone, which is 866-687-7223, or by email. I don't know if the movie convinced a lot of people. Maybe it wasn't supposed to convince anyone that going to the moon was a good thing. Of course, the context for that was back of the time, not in 2018, except we are talking about going back to the moon today, and we are talking about a lot of government money being used in a lunar program again today. And you could make the same arguments about rebuilding most American cities with that money. Let's start with Chicago. Maybe you could clean up Chicago and all of its crime with the money we spend on our space program. I mean, they talked about New York in the movie, but those arguments still exist. And but the context of the Cold War was totally lost, even though, in my opinion, they did show some competition with the Soviet Union and some firsts by the Soviet Union. But, man, I grew up with that, and that era was the Soviet Union scared the crap out of people.
Yes,
and, you know, they blew up a 50-megaton H-bomb, and we were ducking cover drills all through school, even through junior high school, maybe through high school, I don't remember. We had the Sputnik scare, how badly we were behind in math and sciences from the Soviet Union, remember? And all of that kind of stuff. And Kennedy was a godsend with this project to demonstrate what we could do and to prove it. And, of course, I was a space geek from way back, so I loved the idea of being in space, but that really had very little to do with it. And it wasn't just competition like we're competing today. We were fighting a Cold War, which was a real war. I don't know. I think a lot of the context was lost, and I'm a little bit offended by that.
Yeah. Well, let me talk a little bit about some of the things that I think are very positive.
Okay.
Okay. Let me put the positive spin on it here. First of all, it's talking about things that a lot of people weren't aware of. X-15 and Gemini, especially. You know, everybody knows Apollo. Everybody knows we landed on the moon. Well, at least the people who don't think that Kubrick did it. But the point is, it's nice to see these things in there. Armstrong had a very interesting career on the X-15 with the flights that he had. I think they made a huge mistake in the way that the flight itself was portrayed. They made it look, in my opinion, like it was the aircraft's fault, and it was not the aircraft's fault. It was Neil's fault. And then you go on into Gemini, and the Gemini 8 mission was a very harrowing experience. And that one was absolutely 100% saved by Neil Armstrong. It was not his fault at all, and he is the one who got that thing under control. So absolute 100%, he is the one to say was the guy in charge on that and brought that vehicle back. And Apollo 11, of course, his whole idea of getting down on the surface with literally only seconds to spare of fuel, an amazing engineering and flight accomplishment, wonderful stuff. And the big thing that I really did like about the movie, which was that they were trying to put you into Neil's eyes as much as possible. So there was a lot of point of view shots. And I thought that was sort of cool, especially when you get on the moon, because getting the feeling of going down the ladder and standing on the lunar surface and things like that, that's pretty neat to be able to try to put yourself into the context of being in that situation. So I really, really highly did like those things. But again, going back to the problems, a lot of these context things were missing. We missed so many of the connections between X-15 to Gemini to Apollo. There was no real continuity between it. It's just these three missions, and we missed so many things that were in between that would have let people understand it a lot better. And I'll tell you my biggest pet peeve with the whole film is the fact in all three cases, X-15, Gemini, and Apollo, those guys really had it in for vibrating the heck out of their astronaut and out of the audience. And I got to say that that's the one thing that was just, that really irked me, that they kept doing that. If they were getting the kind of vibrations that they showed in all three cases, all of those vehicles would have been torn to shreds, let alone what would have happened to the astronauts inside.
You have a phone call. You ready for it?
Sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to our program tonight. Who are you and where are you? Thank you for calling.
Hi, David. This is Gene in Pasadena.
Hi, Gene.
This is a quick one here. I have not seen the movie yet. Of course, I've read the reviews, and I've seen some of the reviews and the previews and all that. That's some I'd list for next coming weekend. But I wouldn't be too discouraged by the fact that, say, the X-15 was not covered in as much detail as your guests would like. And I go to the conversation that you heard next to you, David, in the theater, where people were saying, what's the X-15? Was that a precursor somehow to the moon rocket? There's a lot of people there that don't know, but I think there's a lot of people younger people that will see that movie, and because of what Musk is doing now, talking about going around the moon, and even Bezos is talking about going back there, I think these younger people are going to get very interested in how it started in the first place. And all they have to do is go to their phones, Google this and Google that, and they'll get the whole story in, 5 or 10 or 20 or minutes or half an hour, as much as they want to spend with it. And I think it'll also drive a lot of people to read the book, younger people, to read the book. So they'll get those details there. So this might unintentionally be a way to, drive these people into learning more on their own about the history of the X-15 program and the early Apollo programs and Gemini and the rest of it, without having to portray it in a movie where you've only got a certain amount of time, and they seem to be focused on kind of the drama of Neil's life and his motivations and the things that drove him. So I wouldn't be too, too discouraged about this. I think it's going to trigger a wave of interest in among young people that, like you say, they were not around when they saw this. I mean, when it happened, I think it's going to drive a lot of them to their own resources, just their phone, nothing, You know, they don't have to, like we had to do, David, they don't have to go to the library and look stuff up and, you know, try to track down somebody that worked in the space program and talk to them. They can get all that information in the palm of their hand. In fact, they've already got it in the palm of their hand. I'm surprised the guy next to you in the theater wasn't, you know, Googling X-15 right in the middle of the movie.
Well, you're making an assumption they actually care, and they care deeper than what is being presented to them in the movie. My hunch is if they had gone to see Venom, they might maybe Google something more about Venom before they Google the Moon program. But I'm jaded because I talk to so many people at the supermarket and here and there because I wear Space Show T-shirts or I wear SpaceX T-shirts. SpaceX T-shirts get the most feedback of any of my space clothing that I ever wear. They all know Musk. They all know Tesla, and they all know he launches rockets. They don't know crap about space or how a rocket works or doing anything. They know he wants to go to Mars. They don't know anything about Mars. But, boy, do they know the words SpaceX, and they know Elon Musk. So he's the champion for T-shirts that I wear. I want to hear what Michelle has to say, but you're making this assumption that the young people that see it really are going to care enough to do some research behind what they saw.
Well, if that film was done 20 years ago, 10 years ago, I don't think they quite would have been that interested because, you know, the young people, I'm older than you are, David, and the younger people that I talk to in that, you know, late teens, early 20s, even 30s, they often will put the Apollo program right next to building of the pyramids. You know, to them, it's all something that happened when, you know, before the iPhone was invented, which is all a blur going all the way back to the discovery of fire and the wheel.
Well, let's hear what Michelle has to say about your idea. What do you think? You think it'll be a big inspiration turning point for younger folks?
Well, I have a feeling it probably won't be a huge inspiration, but I hope that it will. I would like to be optimistic like Gene and say, yeah, that would be a jumping off point. I'll take myself as an example on this. Back in 1975, there was a little movie you might have heard of called Jaws. Okay, and in this movie, there was a scene where they're all sitting around at night and they're comparing their scars. And you might know where I'm going with this, but the big one that comes out of this is Quint sits there and talks about the fact about the USS Indianapolis.
Right.
And at that moment, before he started talking about that, I had never heard of the USS Indianapolis. And after he mentioned that, and after he told that story about what happened to those men who went into the water, I was fascinated, and I went out there back in the days before internet, and I started looking this stuff up and finding out what had happened. So, and you know, to this day, I've read I don't know how many books on the subject and everything else. There's some great books out there. It was just a fascinating moment in history, and it never would have come about if I hadn't seen that one scene in Jaws. And so I'm so glad they included it, because it's made my life richer in the knowing this history. So I hope there will be people that will be out there and get that same instigation and go out and do this kind of research themselves and hopefully look up these books. So I will go with Gene and say I remain optimistic about it.
So, Gene, I think you're jaded, and here's why. And by the way, I also hope you're correct. But when I was in Pasadena yet again a couple of months ago for the Mars Society gig, so I went shopping in Safeway near the hotel where I was staying, which was about a mile from the convention center. And I was wearing, what was I wearing? I was wearing a Space Show T-shirt, a Space Show shirt that I wore to the conference. It says Space Show on it. And I would say 60% of the people in Safeway, I went at about 8 o'clock at night, on Thursday night, had NASA, JPL, and other space-related logo wear clothing or hats. I'm not kidding you. It was all JPL folks, NASA folks, space people, aerospace startups, entrepreneurial companies, things that I was familiar with but I didn't have any real experience with. And that's the community. That's you know, Pasadena, which is where you are. It is a very high space and technical and rocket and all of this kind of stuff environment. Then I went to a Walgreens, which was closer to the convention center. Same kind of thing. All sorts of space paraphernalia being worn by people in the middle of the day. I went to the Starbucks. That probably doesn't count because there was a lot of overflow from the conference going into the Starbucks. So I can imagine there people are, you know, wearing nomenclature for clothing. So, but the point is you're not in Ames, Iowa, or Chicago, or even New York City, or Houston, Houston might be, or Dallas, Texas, for example, or Oklahoma City. We could go across the board where they're not in space-aware communities, and they don't see people and take it for granted that there is this incredible industry out there with Elon Musk. I even saw people with SpaceX shirts on. So, You're in a highly sensitized, knowledgeable, aware area, and yeah, maybe in Pasadena, in that area where people go to see the movie, they will dig a little deeper. Maybe they'll have a friend whose father worked on the program, or who works at JPL, or does this or that, and they will dig a little bit deeper. Middle America, the rest of America, here in San Francisco, up in the Northern California where I live, I don't see it. I hope you're right. I wish there was a way to evaluate that as a possible outcome of the movie, but I seriously doubt there'll be any studies or research like that.
But, well, one way is to look at the book sales, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
If those book sales pick up after the movie, right there, that'll tell you something about, you know, what the reaction is here.
What happens?
Because the people that pick up the book will be the ones, like the people sitting next to you, David, in the theater, that don't quite understand what they saw as far as the technology goes. And, of course, you're not going to get the entire nation to run out and buy the book and start Googling X15 and the rest of it. But you're going to get a percentage of people that took the time to go to see that movie, because in the promotional stuff about the film, you see that it's about the first moon landing. So, you know, that's the core. But they also see that there was a lot of, just from the previews again, a lot of back and forth and argument about whether, you know, how we should go there, what we should do. Is this going to work? Is that going to work? So kind of the drama of that, I think, was, again, I haven't seen the movie, but it's in the promos, and I think that's part of what will draw people in to come and see it. And I've gotten a visa and a passport to go to Bakersfield. And, you know, and I talk to people out there occasionally, younger people, and the younger people are fascinated, becoming fascinated by space because of Musk. And I think this will just sort of add another sort of brick to the tower here that they're building. They're getting excited about them actually going there in their lifetimes, to the moon, maybe to Mars. And I think there's a certain segment of them, might only be 5 or 10 or 15%, but that's more than, you know, what we had before the movie came out, that will be interested enough to do a little research. And doing the research is so much easier now than it was, David, in fact, even your guests, when we were younger and we had to go to the library and look up this and look up that. It's all right there. So it's not easy to trigger the interest, the curiosity in young people.
Okay, so I just looked on Amazon. Okay, so First Man, I didn't look up Michelle's book, but First Man, as of this moment, is number 68 in astronautics and spaceflight, number 113 in history of engineering and technology, and number 114 in aeronautics and astronautics. The book has been out for a week. Unfortunately, I didn't think about doing this before. I wish you would have emailed me. I would have done this the day I went to see the damn movie. But I've written it down. And I'll watch it over the next couple of weeks and see how sales of the book on Amazon might change. Now, I don't know that used book sales are computed in that. Maybe you know how Amazon does it, Michelle. I don't. But there's a lot of used book sellers, and if you want the paperback or the hardback as a used book, it's a fraction of the cost of the original hardback, which is up there around $80 to $100.
Right. So I'll give it to you from my perspective. My book right now is number 151 in astronautics and spaceflight. So that's not too awfully bad for a book that's been out for 5.5 years. I'm not going to complain about that. But, of course, I'd love to see the numbers a lot higher.
Are you seeing a pickup because of the movie?
I haven't really noticed that much change. It's been around this for a little while. Let's see. I did one about a week or so ago. And do I have it sitting here? Okay, it came out actually a week ago. It was, yeah, on the 12th, on the day that the movie came out, I was 112 in astronautics and spaceflight.
And what are you today again?
151.
So you dropped down.
Dropped down a little bit, yeah.
Well, it's only been out a few days.
It's been out a week.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, people are not going to order the book, you know, as soon as they get to their car after they walk.
Well, why not?
Should.
They should. They can do it right off of their cell phones, as you said.
Yeah.
But, you
well,
know, the
I guess in Pasadena, they probably would, but, you know.
Sales of the movie have been disappointing. You know, it's not been a great box office. It was down to number 3 the opening week behind Venom and one other movie. I forget the other one that was a big-name movie that came out at the same time. So they thought it was going to do better at the box office, so it didn't. And I suspect part of the reason why it didn't is because it's weak on the connections and transitions, and maybe a lot of people didn't follow it or really thought they were going to see a lot more cool rocket blasting, you know, adventure scenes. I mean, I'd probably say 80% is his personal life with Janet. Wouldn't you say that, Michelle? Maybe 85% of the movie is Neil's personality.
I don't know if it's quite that much. I'd probably give it maybe about 70%, something like that. But you know, the exact percentage obviously is up for grabs. We could sit there when we get the DVD or whatever and do the calculation. But yeah, there's a lot on the personal life. I don't have any problem with the personal life. I really didn't have a problem with how both Janet and Neil were portrayed. I think they were probably fairly accurate in their portrayal. I did have a problem with the fact that they were just sort of making some stuff up at times in order to move the story forward. Since we don't want to give any spoilers, I'll just say that there is an aspect of the movie, once you see it, you'll make the connection to another movie, a really great movie called A Beautiful Mind. I don't know, David, since you've seen it, you might already know that connection that I'm talking about. But it was just a little weird on how they did things, and there are certain things that they did that we know did not happen.
Well, I was so mesmerized by what's-her-name in A Beautiful Mind that I don't remember anything but her.
Oh, Jennifer Connelly.
Jennifer Connelly, except her. I didn't even remember her name, but I certainly, that image of her is there. So that was it for the movie for me.
Oh, okay.
So I was taken aback by that. But I didn't know the story in A Beautiful Mind, so I relied on the movie to tell me the story. Unfortunately, I know the Neil Armstrong story and Apollo and the moon race and Gemini and all of this, so I could fact check in my mind. What I didn't know was a lot of his personal life with Janet and his kids. I really didn't know a lot about that at all, so I'm assuming it's relatively correct. I know didn't he divorce from Janet? He had affairs, and he had a mixed, troubled life, but most of the Apollo astronauts did have a troubled personal life.
Well,
his lifestyle issues are something that would appeal to, you know, the 40-plus crowd, for instance, because we've gone through that when we get into our 40s. We have kids, we have families, we have, you know, divorces, affairs, those kind of things are of interest to us. But to a 15 or 20-year-old, I'm not sure that's going to be that appealing. So it's not surprising to me that a kind of a human interest story about the space program like this,
they tune it out.
Might not fire up the.
The death of his daughter probably doesn't grab younger people, and, you know, and all of that, and his reaction to that. Although many of us of our age have lost children, or we have really good friends who have lost children. So we have a different impression for that.
The first Star Wars movie have been if Luke Skywalker was 45 years old, you know.
Well, heroes aren't that old, usually.
But that's kind of one of the points of the book. But I do think, I don't think this is going to have a negative effect on younger people's interest in space. And I think there's a percentage of the people in the audience, the young men and young women, that now are going to look at that. And because of what Musk is doing and the flight around the moon and all these other things that are starting to crop up, I think there's a certain percentage of people that are going to see that and say, well, what the heck was the X-15? And what was all of this about? And they're going to take a few minutes and take a look at it and maybe pick up the book and see what's going on. So it sounds like it wasn't the perfect movie for what we would all have liked to see as far as the portrayal goes. But I'm shocked that, David, that you believe that Hollywood would actually enhance any storylines.
I mean, I'm not saying much about this because I don't want to piss off a lot of people, but I think that a lot of the movie was politicized to the political outview and opinions of the people who made the movie. And I personally, my opinion is, having gone through this era, and I went through it in Middle America in Tulsa, that none of the context of the space program, the Cold War, doing test flights at Edwards, you know, the kinds of things that were going on back there, none of that was there. Even though I was only 5 or 6 years old, I used to listen to news reports with my parents on an old-fashioned crazy little radio Saturday and Sunday morning when they were trying to sleep late on what was going on in the Korean War. So to me, that entire era is very different from what was portrayed in the movie. And
it's not a biopic. I mean, it is a biopic, but it's not a biography of his life.
I understand that, but the context to me of why we even were spending this money and going to the moon, and all of that was absent from my perspective. So I know not everyone's going to agree with that, and I know from the flag controversy and the news comments, and they said this was all about global commons and global humanity and this and that. And I know their outlook was very different. They're the ones making the movie, not me. Nobody asked me to do a screenwriting job for Jim Hansen. But I was a little bit surprised and offended that so much of the context of all of this that I remember from living through it was simply not there. And
On Friday when you get Buzz on the show, maybe you
He's not coming on. I've already removed him from the website.
Oh, yeah.
He's had some issues that have come up, and hopefully he'll come on later, but he will not be on the show this Friday. It'll strictly be Henry Vanderbilt. Anyway, Gene.
Just ask him, you know, when they make the movie The Second Man, you know, if they could.
Gene, I got to move on, okay? So anything else? Otherwise, I'm going to move on and see if someone else wants to call. Thank you.
Hoping to keep this short anyhow, but that didn't work out.
Thanks.
All right.
Listeners, if you want to call, give us a call. The line is now available again, 1-866-687-7223. What about the part of his personal life with Janet? I didn't really know very much about it. I knew he lost a daughter, and I knew he's kind of a hard-nosed, stoic kind of guy. Was that really pretty accurate? Was the portrayal of Janet really like what his wife was like? Who did you meet? Did you get to meet any of his family members, his sons, or anyone like that?
I spoke with Neil on several occasions when I was researching the book, and a wonderful guy, but he definitely wants to stay on topic and such. I've also met and spoken with both Mark and Rick, his two sons.
Uh-huh.
I never did get a chance to meet Janet, but everything that I know after reading the book and from other sources and stuff, I think that the portrayal of the family life was probably pretty accurate. I know that both Mark and Rick have gone on record saying that, yeah, this was our dad. So, you know, there's a good aspect as far as that goes. But again, there's things that were added. Again, I don't want to get into the spoiler territory if you don't want me to, but there were things that they added. They tried to make the daughter's death was the thing that held the whole movie together. And I think that was sort of a mistake. It's hard without talking more about it and giving more away. But there were things there that were made up that I don't think should have been included, because that's what really forced the story from the filmmaker's perspective. They were trying to force it to be something that I don't think it necessarily was. Neil was not a guy who showed his emotions a lot. He just didn't do that. He still had a great sense of humor and stuff, especially if you talk to the people who knew him, who were close to him. When I talked to Paul Bickle, who was his boss on the X-15, Paul and him got along great. They were wonderful friends up until the day that Paul died back in the 1980s. They were both glider pilots, so they had the shared context of being pilots. And there was Neil had a lot of humor and stuff as well in these kind of contexts. But to the exterior world, we rarely got to see that. Only if you were a good friend in his inner circle did you see that. And so the way it comes across in the movie is that, yeah, he's a very stoic isn't even the right word. I mean, in many ways, it's like Cherie, my wife, was talking about it, that she basically saw it as depressing. And I definitely would agree with her on that, that I think that there was a great depressing access to it. It was just not really showing the full humanity. But in the long run, too, with Janet, you know, I believe they divorced in 94 or something like that. I may have the numbers wrong there. But in the long run, it was my understanding that even after all those years, 32 years after they lost their daughter, that Neil never once brought up the death of their daughter. It was just something that he never spoke about, even in intimate occasions with his own wife and family. And that was one of the things that led to the divorce. So those are the kind of things that I think would have been better to be put into context. But that they really short shrifted us on some of the other avenues of Neil's life.
So this will be a spoiler, so listeners, if you don't want to hear my question to Michelle and turn off the radio, but I was not aware, and so tell me if this is made up for the movie or for real, that Neil threw his daughter's bracelet into a crater on the moon.
That is 100% false as far as we know.
Okay, so because that totally got by me if it really happened. So that was something for the effect of the movie.
Well, it's something that Hansen talks about. You know, he spoke with Janet and he spoke with Mark and Rick and other people from the family to ask this kind of a question. Janet made a comment in Hansen's book that I thought was very telling, where she was actually very, very pissed off at Neil because Neil did not take anything personal to the moon. She said, I always expected that he put in his personal preference kit some items that he would bring back from the moon to give to his sons, and he did not do that. And it's like, how could he not do that for his own sons, to not leave them something like that? And so to think that he neglected his living sons to take that bracelet along, there's absolutely nothing that shows he did anything like that at all, that there was anything that he was thinking about his daughter when he was walking around on the lunar surface.
I have another caller waiting, but sure. Ed is in Tucson with an email, so I'll go ahead and read his email. He says, I've seen the movie. I kind of believe and think about it the way all of you do. Neil had heart problems. I understand he had heart problems while on the moon. None of that was in the movie. Any comments about that?
I don't recall hearing that he had any heart problems on the moon. There were other astronauts. Jim Irwin.
Irwin did. So I think Neil's heart problems were post his lunar experience.
Yeah, he had his heart attack and stuff, which eventually led to his open heart surgery and then the loss of Neil. But I don't believe that was ever anything that was out there at the time that he was on the moon. So I think that he might be juxtaposing, say, what happened to Jim Irwin.
Yeah, I think Ed, you do have the dates wrong on that. But and the story stopped when Neil went to the moon. So what happened with Neil post the moon? Even the Chevron gas commercial for whatever that additive was, where he felt he got screwed by.
And Chrysler.
None of that was in the movie either. The other thing, and then I'll go to the thing, is they show scenes with the three guys in the isolation booth or whatever trailer, whatever.
Right.
So I remember seeing it in Look magazine or Life magazine, you know, and I've still got those magazines sealed in plastic. It didn't look anything like what they showed in the movie.
No.
So there was nothing that high-tech, modern, luxurious. I mean, it was like a trailer that was supposed to be, you know, aside from ants going in and out of it, an isolation.
Well, let me comment on that real quick.
And okay.
I'll get to the caller. But there's actually what they showed in that case was not that inaccurate.
Okay.
Because there was the trailer that was waiting for them on the Hornet when they landed.
Uh-huh.
And they were put into the isolation trailer. Once they were transferred, they were taken off in Hawaii and then flown in the trailer back to Houston. And then there was a section of the Manned Space Flight Center there that was set up as an isolation area. And so that's what they were showing.
Okay.
That scene in the movie was not supposed to take place in the trailer. It was after they already got back to Houston.
So there again, minus context, and you can think about the wrong thing, which
right.
I did. But let's see who our caller is. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show with Michelle. Who are you? Where are you? And thank you for calling.
This is John Fort Worth.
Hi there.
Yeah, I saw the movie last Friday. I don't know. My reaction to it was that it was, of course, I guess that's a little bit what people are saying, but I saw it as kind of just a biographical movie, not about the space program itself, but more a look into personal life. But I guess I'm hearing some inaccuracies as well as accuracies. I'm kind of glad to get a feel of what might have been inaccurate versus what, you know. I always am suspicious of movies like that, throwing in spurious stuff. But I sense that it seems to me to be a bit of an introverted kind of person, engineering, pilot, very focused on what he's doing. And basically, the reason why I got the sense why he was picked to be the first moon, on the first moon mission to be the landing pilot was that he'd been through several incidents where they were near disasters, not his fault, of course, but technical problems. And in each case, he managed to get out of it and fix the problem. And they kind of figured he'd be the one guy who would make the right decision and would get him to the moon safely and would only abort if he absolutely had to.
Well, I think you're very right in many ways on that. There is, you know, what happened on Gemini 8 and the things that happened leading up to Apollo 11, including the loss of the lunar landing research vehicle in May of 68. You know, he did handle those really excellently, and I know that that was part of the reason that they put him as commander of Apollo 11. He was definitely the right guy for the job. I think he was the perfect first man on the moon. You know, Neil was not in it for the aggrandizement or anything else. He made some things like the Chrysler commercial we talked about and stuff, but other than that, he never sat there and, you know, built on his own fame. And so I really think that he was the right person at the right time for the right job. Going back a little bit further in the context of what I wish they'd maybe said a little bit more of in the movie, just from my personal preference on the X-15. First of all, we really need a good movie about the X-15, which I can talk about more later if you want as well. But the thing that happened because of what was going on in his life with the loss of Karen and stuff like that, he screwed up three times right in a row, one thing after another, during the X-15 program in the early parts of 1962. And those were things that he screwed up. It wasn't where things screwed up and then he was able to recover from them. He's the one who caused the problems, and such as the X-15 flight that went awry. There was no problem with the X-15 at all. And then he had two other incidents that occurred out at dry lake beds and stuff, not in the X-15. And Paul Bickle was going to ground him for what he did, because he was saying, you know, Neil, you're screwing up. And so he literally was going to ground him. He put him on remedial flights where he had to be on a flight with another person, specifically Joe Walker. And it came to the point where Neil understood that he needed to get out of that situation. And that's when he applied for the astronaut office in Houston. And interestingly, when he made that application, he did not put Paul Bickle down as a personal reference. And although they did end up calling Paul, and Paul told him, it's like, I don't think you should actually take Neil. But they did anyway. And, of course, the rest was history after that. He did much better after he got away from Edwards and started to really turn things around.
Now, the Apollo 8 thing was another thing. I mean, I do recall the incident after the movie brought it up, but I guess I didn't quite grasp, and that's just, I mean, of course, at the time, how old was I? 11, something like that. 12, something like that. So I do recall the incident, but I didn't recall just how serious it really was, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Gemini 8 was definitely life-threatening. They came very close to losing consciousness because of the G-forces of the runaway RCS thruster. And if they had lost consciousness, there would have been no recovery.
Yeah. So that was, yeah, but I do recall an incident. I think the NASA didn't portray it publicly at the time it happened as serious as it really was, right? Did they? I mean, they knew they had the leak come back early, but I don't think quite.
Yeah, I think you're correct that, of course, they tried to downplay it. You know, it's the kind of thing that happened with Apollo 13, too. You know, they try to put the best face on it. And basically, for so many years, they sort of just tried to ignore that Apollo 13 ever even happened, so much so that the Apollo 13 spacecraft was not even in the country for many years. But, yeah, Gemini 8, it's like, hey, we got the crew back, and let's make a hero out of Armstrong, and then let's just get on to the next program or the next flight as quickly as we can.
Was Apollo 8 our first successful manned space flight first, I'm thinking, because, you know, the Russians have beaten us to so many things, first in space, first in orbit, first to fly two craft at the same time, I believe, first woman, actually, whatever, you know, free manned spacecraft, first spacewalk, but that rendezvous and dock is one they hadn't done.
We did that with Gemini, of course.
Eight, I believe, is the first.
Gemini 8 was the first hard dock in space, and that was accomplished by Neil.
Yeah. I was watching the show, I was thinking through that, and I'm thinking that really was our real first manned space first, you know, because everything else we were doing after the Russians, basically.
Yeah, that was the first time that we really started to pull ahead of the Russians. Gemini 8, when we proved that we could do a hard dock in space, they were not even close to being able to do something like that at that point. And so from that point on, we were finally ahead in the space race all the way through to landing on the moon. I always wish there was talk that they were very close the Russians were to getting a single man around the moon on what was called the Zond program. And if it had gone on maybe a couple of more months, they might have been able to pull one of those off. And I really wish they'd pulled off around the moon flight, because that would have proven to the world that they were still aiming for the moon. The problem was, we got there with Apollo 8 and went into orbit, didn't just do a figure eight and come right back. And everything was so bang, bang, bang with Apollo 8 and Apollo 9 with the testing of the lunar module, going to the moon and almost coming down to within 10,000 feet on Apollo 10, and then, of course, landing on 11. And then the Russians said, oh, we never planned on going to the moon anyway. And even though our agencies like the CIA knew better, because they knew they had the N-1 moon rocket flying over there, even though it was never successful, they allowed the Russians to get away with saying, we never planned to go to the moon, and thus it was the excuse to cancel Apollo and say, well, we don't need to keep going back. So I wish that the Russians had gotten one more first, and that was a swing around the moon. I think that the space program today would be a lot different if that had happened.
Yeah. I would definitely say the failure of the Russian moon program was kind of very detrimental to that, to our programs, too. I think you're right about that. The other thing, well, I guess we had to something a little Apollo-related, at least. Now, this is one of my bugaboos, but I always look at, in fact, we were discussing this at work today with somebody, that you know, we had three completed spacecraft that could go to the moon for an 18, 19, and 20 and didn't fly them.
Yep.
You know, and I'm sort of left with the viewpoint that the Apollo 13 incident, after that, we had to kind of do some more just to show we weren't afraid and we weren't giving up, you know. And then, but politically, the political people at the outside of NASA, probably above them, you know, were saying, you know, we got to shut this thing down before a real disaster happens, because now we can rest on our laurels as being the winner and the space race and moon race, and we don't have to take a chance on losing a crew or something.
Well, remember, the public was not very supportive of it. They were afraid that the Saturn V was due for a big accident, and and, you know, the economy was definitely turning south as a result of the Vietnam War and other stuff. So they had a lot of reasons to kill the program, and it wasn't a program about space like we would like it to be today. It was a Cold War program.
Right.
And they proved their points in the Cold War, which eventually, you know, ended up in our favor. So I don't think they cared about space like we, as you know, space advocates and space enthusiasts care about it. I don't think they gave a hoot about any of that.
Well, there were certainly a lot of people that did care about space, but the people that held purse strings were the politicians.
Well, yeah,
the ones
policy
that did not care.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, the whole thing too was, looking at it from the political standpoint, we started the Apollo program by the edict of President Kennedy. And then, of course, when we lost him, and then after Johnson, and we ended up into Nixon, the opposite political party and Nixon did not want anything to be identified with JFK. And so, of course, he oversaw the dismantling of the Apollo program. It's like, okay, we got there, we did what we wanted to do, we've run this thing out as much as I want you to run it out, because I want you to be paying more attention to what I'm doing as a president, such as opening relations with China or what have you. And he just didn't want to be identified with John F. Kennedy anymore. I don't know if you're familiar with the idea, but the original intent of Apollo 11 was it was going to be picked up by the aircraft carrier, the John F. Kennedy. And Nixon said, no way in hell am I going to let that name get that closely associated with this mission. I'm the one that's got my name on the plaque, on the lunar module, and all that, and that's the way it's going to stay. And JFK is gone as far as I'm concerned. And it was really terrible that that happened, but he got away with it, and people have allowed him to get away with it now for 50 years.
Well, Nixon was no fun, not fond of the Kennedys, that's for sure.
No.
But I'm just still thinking we built the equipment. I mean, we actually had the rockets, we didn't save much money by not flying the missions is all.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
It was nominal. And given the fact that that was our last ability to do that, it just seems very sad to me. But that's just my thought.
No, I definitely agree with you.
Yeah,
I think we all do.
The last thing I want to bring up, which may have also played into the movie, the success or failure of it, is this is sort of a issue, the whole flag issue. And I was looking to see what I thought about that in the movie, and my view is they didn't do much real moonwalking scenes
right.
in the movie where you'd have to have wires on the actors and, you know, to do that kind of bouncy maneuver you do they were doing up there. And so that's one reason why I think it wasn't in there, was just they didn't do any of those kind of special effects.
Well, they did do some of the moonwalking. All of the stuff they showed on the lunar surface was actually done outdoors at night in a rock quarry, which was very interesting. It's the first time they've done that sort of thing actually on an outdoor set. But, yeah, the whole flag controversy, I got to say, I think it's really overblown. It's sort of ridiculous. The American flag is in this movie a lot of places. It's on the side of rockets. It's on the side of the spacesuits. It's there. To actually sit there and say, well, this is a horrible movie because they didn't show them actually pounding the stake into the ground up there on the lunar surface and actually sticking the flag in there and watching it unfurl, I think that's ridiculous. We see the flag on the moon, but that wasn't the point of what we were seeing. They also didn't show them setting up the retroreflector or the solar wind collector or any of the other things that they did, the heat flow experiments. You know, this was not a documentary. This was a look at the life of Neil Armstrong. And that's what we saw. And we literally saw it through his eyes. And Neil was very adamant that for him, walking on the moon was not that big of a thing. It's like, well, gee, you know, when I land my jet, I get out and I walk around. For him, he always stated that the biggest thing on that mission for him was getting that Lunar Module Eagle down on the lunar surface safely. That was the engineering accomplishment. That's what he did as a pilot, and that was what made that flight worthwhile. Opening the door, walking around, big deal. That's the way he really felt about it.
Well, he's right about that because, I mean, they kind of run into a rougher area to land in than they really anticipated. And
yeah. Yeah, there was a crater and a bunch of boulders and stuff, yeah, and he had to take over. I'm sure that no matter what, he probably would have found a good excuse to have taken over from the automatic control on the landing. To go all the way there and say, I'm not going to get to land this thing properly myself as a pilot, that ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
Anything else, John?
I think that'll be it. I'll let somebody else call in then.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Listeners, you can give us a call if you want. It is 1-866-687-7223. Are we going to see an X-15 movie based on your book?
Oh, I hope so.
Well, is it in the works? And you just can't tell us, or it's
no. There's unfortunately nothing in the works. For some of your listeners, you may be familiar with the fact that there has been one X-15 movie already made. It came out in 1961. And it starred the huge stars of the time of Charles Bronson and Mary Tyler Moore in her first big screen appearance. And that movie was interesting, to say the least. There's some cool stuff in it, but overall it was just sort of a soap opera. The best thing about it is that it was narrated by Jimmy Stewart. I love that stuff. It's got some great flight footage in it, but it's not really a movie about the X-15 that much. And it deserves it. That vehicle was such a key to us opening up space flight.
and I really wish that somebody would take seriously the idea of doing the proper story. I'll throw out my own two cents on this thing, and the fact that there was a really great miniseries out there called From the Earth to the Moon. And my personal opinion is the X-15 would best be handled with a very similar type of a series. It's like if you read my book, the book is set up in 12 primary chapters. Each chapter is basically a bio of one of the 12 pilots. And I think that each one of those pilots are people that the general public should know more about, because each of them was a really amazing person in their own right. And then, of course, all the peripheral people making the X-15 happen. So that's the way I'd really like to see it handled. But even just doing a proper motion picture would be really good, because I think people need to see that context that we've lost in this movie and in other places. The X-15 originally was supposed to be in the movie The Right Stuff, and it got canceled out. It is in the book The Right Stuff. It also showed up, it did show up in the movie. It was sitting there as a model in Pancho Barnes' Happy Bottom Writing Club. It also showed up in the latest Star Trek movie in a shot as a model, but that's as far as we've seen of screen time for the X-15 since 1961, and 57 years is a long time that needs to be made up for, and somebody needs to pick this up and do something with it.
And you have one X-15 pilot alive today, correct?
That is correct. Out of the 12 guys, there's only one person left, Joe Engel. He did work as a technical advisor on First Man, which was wonderful. He at least got credit. That was something I got, you know, with 3 months of working on the film, they didn't even give me a credit. I was a little ticked about that, too. They took away my ability to go see it on the lake bed out there, and they didn't even give me a thank you. But
did they give you a discount ticket to the movie?
Didn't even get a discount ticket for the movie. No, didn't even get to go see it for free.
Well, maybe you can get the model, the mock-up, and put that in your backyard or something.
Sure, no problem. I think it would be a little large for our condo, but right now the biggest model of the X-15 I have is about 4 feet, which is still a pretty good size model. I will say that it's about 1/15 scale. And if I can throw out a quick plug on that, anybody who'd like to see this model and some other artifacts from the X-15, including things that actually flew into space on the X-15, this coming Saturday at 11 a.m., I will be doing a talk at the Western Museum of Flight in Torrance, and the talk is entitled In the Line of Duty, Michael Adams and the X-15, and it's the story about the 12th and final X-15 pilot, Michael J. Adams, in the Air Force, and he was actually the very first United States astronaut who was lost in the line of duty during a space flight. And again, nobody knows who this guy is. So I've got two talks that I do on my book, but this is the first one that I've done that's geared to just one single pilot, and I'm really proud of the way it's come out, and I hope that some people will come out and join us. And as far as I know, it looks like we're also going to have at least several X-15 guys there as well, so anybody that wants to come and shake the hands of anybody who actually worked on this program, come to Torrance to the Western Museum of Flight on Saturday, and you'll get that opportunity.
Were you pleased that they renamed Edwards after Neil?
Well, the Dryden Flight Research Center that was renamed as the Armstrong Flight Research Center, I was sort of taken aback by that. And I think that Neil would have been very pissed that they did that. He did not want that kind of recognition. I was out there when they did the official naming ceremony, and Mark and Rick were there as well. And, of course, they, you know, got up there and talked with, you know, all the speeches that were going on and how proud they were of this and how proud they knew their father would be. But I took both of them aside afterward, and I said, do you really think that your father would like to have this happen? And both of them said, no. They just did not think that he would appreciate it at all.
So why did they insist on doing that? Not the sons, but the government that wanted to do this. Why was this compelled and forced on them? Didn't they ask the family and do any research to see if this is something Neil would have wanted?
I think most people that knew Neil would have known right off the bat that he definitely would not have wanted it, but I don't think that would have made any difference as far as this naming goes. The deal was that somebody said, hey, we have to honor Neil, the first man on the moon. He flew here as a research pilot on the X-15, the X-1B, other things there at Edwards. So let's grab this while we can, and let's take the name and make a use of it. And I know that Neil would say there's no way that his name should supplant Hugh Dryden. Dryden, according to what Neil would say, was a much bigger figure in aeronautical research than Neil, who would say, hey, I was an engineer, I was a pilot, I was nothing special. Especially when you look at his record at Edwards, as I said, he screwed up three major times in those last few months he was at Edwards, so he left under a cloud. And so to name the research facility after him today is almost a bit of a, I don't know, it's a little weird.
Is Janet still alive today?
No, she's passed away.
So she passed away.
Well, yeah.
You have another email, and this is from Doug in Denver. And he says, years and years ago, I was at a conference where Neil was speaking. I think it was a conference. Maybe I'm mixing it up with something else because it was several years ago. And he mentioned that he actually flew a suborbital spacecraft and flew on a suborbital flight and was talking about X-15 in the context of the talk about suborbital spaceflight that was trying to be developed at the time for space tourists. Do you believe that the X-15 was suborbital spaceflight in the context of what suborbital spaceflight for space tourists is talked about today?
Well, the X-15 certainly did do suborbital flights. We had, out of the 12 pilots, 8 of them earned astronaut wings on the X-15. Joe Engel and Joe Walker both did 3 astronaut qualification flights themselves. Neil, while he was working on the X-15 and flying the research aircraft, he actually did not get his astronaut wings. He did not make it up as far as was necessary to get those wings. At the time, you needed to get to about 266,000 feet, which was 50 miles of altitude. That's
right.
What NASA and the Air Force considered at that time to be qualifying for an astronaut. And the highest that Neil got, I believe, was 207,500 feet, which was on the flight that was depicted in the movie, even though in the movie they only said he went to 140,000 feet, which is another little technical glitch that I wish they would fix. I mean, it would have actually sounded better for the movie if they'd said, hey, he got up to 207,500 feet. But as far as relating this to space tourism, of course, the X-15, there was never any idea that they were doing precursor work for space tourism. That came along much, much later. But the things like Spaceship Two, that's going to be hopefully flying space tourists within the next year or so, is following the same types of trajectories that the X-15 did, but not nearly at the same speeds that the X-15 flew.
Interesting. What else should we be talking about while you're on the air with us? What else is going on that you can share with us or that we've missed or we've overlooked, even including First Man?
Well, as I say, First Man, I think as a space aficionado, you should probably at least go out and take a look and judge for yourself. Again, there are things in it that I did really like, but yeah, there are things I wish they'd just done different. I hope that people will go out and do more research on these things, like the X-15, on the Gemini program. Those are definitely two things that are highly overlooked. And yeah, if you get a chance, come to one of the talks and stuff. And if you get a chance to do that, come up afterwards and say hello, because I love meeting the people who have listened to the shows, who support you and the space show, and those who are excited about the X-15.
Do you at all think that if Neil had been alive and they did this movie, would he be happy with it?
Boy, that's a good question. I think, again, he would probably say, I don't want to go see it, because so many people said he was like a hermit or something. He was not a hermit at all. He was out there quite a bit. But he was very shy when it came to public events. When he got around pilots and stuff, wonderful. You know, he'd go to conferences and things all the time. But when it came to public speaking, it's like, oh, what was it like to land on the moon? He did not want to answer that question for the 15 millionth time. So to see this movie, I think he might have just completely avoided going to see it. I don't think he would want to see it, because he's like, I don't want to see myself up on the big screen. It's just not the kind of guy he was.
Alice is in Seattle with a question for you and said, do you think Gosling played a good Neil? Is he good at the part? What do you think?
I think he did a pretty decent job at it. I think he's got sort of the physical characteristics and stuff. So I've got no problem with his portrayal. I think the problems are with the storytelling itself of what they had Neil doing. As I say, again, if you go back and look at the context, check out the story behind A Beautiful Mind and then see the movie and you'll know what I'm talking about. Again, I know that Neil would have been very, very pissed off about that, because Neil was also one for facts. He's like, you must follow the facts. And so anytime they took liberties with the story, he would have been very, very ticked off about that. But other than that, yes, in answer to your question, I think Gosling did a fine job with what he had to work with.
Roger is in Las Vegas, and he has another question for you. He says, in terms of Neil in real life, not in the movie, he never was as outspoken about space, although later in his life he did come forward with things when they were going to cancel the moon program under President Obama, and he also went to Houston when Columbia had the accident, to the big memorial. But it seemed like many years earlier he stayed along himself. I'm trying to read his note. It doesn't make a lot of sense. I think he was an introvert. Is that a pretty good characterization of him? And what changed later to get him to come out and talk at the different meetings about canceling the moon program and even showing up in Houston when the Columbia accident happened?
Well, first of all, Neil was on the accident investigation board for the Challenger, not on the board for the Columbia.
For Columbia, but he came to Houston.
But as far as that goes, I mean, he was always there when you want to talk about aerospace. For flying the X-15, for flying Apollo, those kind of things, he was there. He went to conferences a lot, actually. I think one of your people earlier talked about meeting Neil at some sort of a conference.
Right.
So he was out there doing these things. Again, he sat down with me in an ice cream parlor to talk about the X-15 back in Ohio, and I saw him so many other times. He was down here in San Diego when they were honoring other astronauts and things. And so he really was out there. I think a lot of people don't understand that about him, that he did put himself out there quite a bit. And I think it was just later in life where there were these things that just happened that we happened to get more coverage of again, with the internet and things like that, you got to see things happening that you might not have seen otherwise. If somebody sees them at a conference and they snap a picture, you know, with their iPhone or something, it's going to get out there where normally it might just go in somebody's, you know, photo file or something. So I don't think there was that much change over the years. I really don't.
Sarah's in Phoenix, and this will probably be the last question of the evening. And she says, I saw the movie, and I know that the movie was a story about McNeil, but I'm wondering if you can characterize in real life for us his relationship with Mike and with Buzz. They both are downplayed and pretty much dismissed in the movie, but what were the three of them like? Were they friends? Did they get along with each other? Did Buzz go to Neil's funeral? Did Mike go to Neil's funeral? Can you shed some light on how they were with one another?
Well, first of all, I'll say Neil did not have a funeral. There was a private memorial service, but he did not have a funeral. His ashes were scattered at sea, and the exact location of where that occurred has been kept a secret, so nobody could even go to the GPS coordinates and say this is where the ashes were thrown off the ship. And he specifically wanted that to happen because he did not want a grave site for people to come and pay their respects. He did not want that to happen. So he left that and said, I want to be cremated and I want to be buried at sea and that's it, or scattered at sea. So the memorial service itself, I don't recall if Buzz and Mike were there. They were not really friends. It's like the Apollo 12 crew. Those guys were best buddies. They loved each other. They partied together. They drove their cars together, all this kind of stuff. The Apollo 11 crew was a crew. They got along to do the job. They were not brought together because they were best buddies at all. And there's always been a lot of friction, I think, between Neil and Buzz. Buzz, to this day, I think, has a lot of resentment against Neil because Neil went out first and was the first guy on the lunar surface. But the way the lunar module was built, there was no way that Buzz could have gotten out first. Neil had to get out first because that's the way the door opened. But, yeah, so to say that they were friends would definitely not be an accurate statement, I don't think at all.
Did they stay in touch after the flight, the three of them, or do you know anything about that?
I can't say for certain, but I know they got together on the anniversary events when they would come in at Houston or at the Cape or something to do maybe a press event for the 10-year, the 25-year, whatever anniversary. And as far as my knowledge goes, I believe that's really the only time they ever got together was when it was an official function like that.
We have another phone call. Can you stay on and take it?
Sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling.
Hi, this is John in Fremont.
Hi, John. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. I saw the movie. I was somewhat disappointed. I'm sorry I joined the show late. Have you guys already talked about the depiction of Buzz in the movie?
I personally left it alone, but we just kind of had a question about how they were dismissed in the movie. Mike was dismissed in the movie too.
Well, and let me, I really didn't properly comment on that. Again, this was Neil's movie. This was his movie. This was about him. It was not about Buzz. It was not about Mike. And I think it's really disingenuous when people come in and say, oh, well, Buzz was, not properly portrayed. Everybody except for Neil and Janet were peripheral characters on this. Everybody is out there at a distance except for those two people. So
yeah.
It's not a diss on Mike or Buzz or any of the other people that were left in the distance. It's just Neil's picture.
Well, yeah, to that extent, half the time I didn't even know who the other astronauts, I don't know what their characters were. I don't know who they were. There was no context, no names introduced. I mean, you knew who Ed was because he addressed Ed several times, and they seemed to have a relationship. But I didn't know who they were talking about or who was coming over for the party or who was this or that. There was no need for them to be identified, I guess.
I was very surprised when I looked at the credits that, you know, people like John Glenn were in there, you know. I mean,
you never know it.
Yeah, because he was never identified, and there were many other astronauts, Wally Schirra and so many other astronauts that we know the names of, and it's like they had characters and they were assigned names, but it's like, huh, where were they?
Yeah, I agree. It was you know, all about Armstrong, but it was pretty negative. I mean, Buzz was portrayed as kind of a buffoon, and you know, I just thought that was kind of insulting, given that, you know, he's still around. But I know it's a movie about Neil. The other question I wanted to ask is how accurate. How much research was done in Armstrong's treatment of his sons just before he left, and you know that scene where you know he's saying he's going to the moon and may not come back. It seemed really insensitive to me, and I know that Neil is my understanding of him is that he's humble, that he's shy, but he's not insensitive the way he was in that scene. And I just wondered how accurate that was, or do you know?
Well, my understanding is, from what I've heard from interviews with the sons, Mark and Rick, is the fact that it was portrayed fairly close to supposedly what happened. Mm-hmm. I'd also remember that Mark and Rick were much younger at the time, so how much are they remembering versus how much it's like, oh yeah, that looks about right. We all have our vagaries of our memories and stuff when we're young, and we can put things in different contexts and stuff when you're looking back at these memories. And I know Mark and Rick have both given the movie great accolades, so I'm not really sure how to take their comment to say it was accurate or not. I do know that, you know, from talking to Neil myself and other people that have spoken to him, that yes, he was a very non-emotional person for the most part, especially when in public. Within his personal life at home, again, my understanding is that was one of the reasons why Jan eventually divorced him, was because she just could not stand this idea that he would not share emotion, such as dealing with the death of Karen and things like that. He would not talk about it. He just would not bring it up.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes to this whole idea, again, that what's the biggest question that he ever got when he was in public? What's it like to walk on the moon? That's the last thing he wanted to talk about was feelings. You wanted to sit down and talk about airplanes. Hey, he'll sit there and talk to you all night long. It's like when I was going to him for my research on the X-15, I wrote him a letter, and this one morning I get a phone call like 7 o'clock in the morning, and it's Neil on the telephone. It wasn't his secretary or anything, and it's like, hey, I got your letter here, and I understand you want to talk about the X-15, and after grilling me enough to know that I knew what I was talking about, he's like, you know, come on out and let's talk about the X-15. Nobody is ever asking me about the X-15.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, thank you for...
So hold on, John. Yeah. Did your wife see the movie, too? Because she's not a space cadet like you are.
She did see the movie with
okay,
me.
Okay,
yeah.
So tell us what she thought. Then how well does she know the story? Does she know it as well as you do, or what did she think?
You know, I don't know if I want to say it.
Is she there?
She thought it was... No, she's not.
I was going to tell you to put her on the phone.
Yeah, I mean, she thought it was okay, but she's not a space enthusiast like I am. So, you know, she was. We were both impressed by the actress portrayal of Janet,
the British woman.
Armstrong.
Yeah,
she was really good.
She was excellent. Yes, very good.
Yeah, But the
she didn't even sound like my British Siri. I still have no idea how these British actors speak American with,
I know.
With so perfectly. Even I can't speak American perfectly. But amazing. You would never know she's from Britain.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, go ahead. I was interrupting you. What were you going to say?
Oh, no. I don't think I have anything else to add beyond, you know, I just had a different concept coming out of that era and you know, the inspiration for space exploration and all that. I didn't come away from the movie as, you know, this. I know it's about Neil. So maybe I was looking for something else, I was just kind of disappointed. But yeah.
All right. Thanks for the call, John.
Could I throw something out here real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
I want to read you a short paragraph. This is from Neil's pilot's report after his X-15 flight. If people want to get a feel for who Neil was and how he handled things and how he looked at things, these are the exact words that he wrote about coming back into the atmosphere and screwing up so that he ballooned back up out of the atmosphere and almost ended up having to land the X-15 in Pasadena or something because he almost didn't have enough energy to get back to Edwards.
Oh, so Gene would have loved that. He'd been back there in his backyard in Pasadena.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So this is how Neil put it in his pilot's report. Although speed brake extension and angle of attack reduction were thought to be performed as scheduled, it soon became obvious that some positive flight path angle had been achieved subsequent to the entry completion. This flight condition, velocity equals 4,000 feet per second, height equals 85,000 feet, gamma equals plus, compounded by an entry completion 20 miles further downrange than predicted, created a situation which precluded the completion of the flight path as planned. A sizable overshooting of the space positioning turn required a straight-in approach to an alternate runway 35.
Say that again, please.
Sure.
Well, that's pretty plain vanilla cut and dry, isn't it?
Exactly. It's like here's one of the things that could have been an absolute catastrophe. That's how he did it. Remember with the LLRV accident where he punched out at the last second. If he had stayed in that thing another second or less, he might not have made it out. And, you know, they portrayed it in the movie that he got, you know, all banged up on the face. He didn't even have that. And he was back in his office less than an hour later just sitting at his desk. And these other guys would come into the astronaut office and it's like, oh, did you hear there was this accident out there? It's like, oh, yeah, I just had to eject. And it's like, what? You just ejected and you're sitting here at your desk? That's who Neil was.
John, anything else?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
I got one more email from you, okay?
Okay.
So Adam is in Kansas City, and he said, I saw the movie. And one thing that I thought was a bit unusual, but maybe it's a liberty taken with the movie, had to do with the cars that were being driven during the time of the movie, which you have now said was between 62 and 69.
Right.
And we know that Neil drove a Corvette because a Corvette claiming to be his was on eBay a couple of years ago being rebuilt. And they claimed they knew it was Neil's Corvette because they had the vehicle identification number and tracked it to being owned by Neil. Obviously, if he drove a Corvette at some point during this, he had to have a different kind of personality than what you're describing. Can you comment on that?
Well, my comment is that I'm not really sure that he had a Corvette.
I remember that everybody was sending the eBay ad around. And I remember
right.
I even talked about it on the Space Show. I probably could find the emails, although I bet the page is long gone. But they were selling Neil Armstrong's blue Corvette. I remember it. An early 60s Corvette. And I think it was being refurbished or something like that. or maybe it was in the condition they got it, and they represented it as being Neil's Chevrolet Corvette. I remember that now, thanks to Adam's email. So
yeah, it's supposed to be a 67 Stingray. I'm not sure what the provenance is on it and how well documented it is. I will tell you that while Neil was at Edwards flying the X-15, he was driving a car that barely started. I mean, he lived up in Juniper Hills on the South Hills in the Palmdale Lancaster area up there. It was an old converted ranger station, and that it was up on top of this hill, so that the way he got his car started in the morning was that he would point the car down the hill and put it in neutral and then try to knock it into gear to get the thing going. I used to have a car I used to have to do that with as well. And it was always a running joke with the people out there that he drove these absolute terrible beater old cars. And it's even a comment from Paul Bickle when Bickle saw him years later, long after the moon landing, where he ended up meeting Neil at a conference having to do with glider pilots, and that they got together and they were talking afterwards, and there was this lady that was there with Paul Bickle, and after Paul and Neil finished talking, Neil got in his car and started it up, and it was all rattling and belching smoke and everything else as he drove away. And the woman turned to Paul and said, "That's the first man on the moon?" It's like, yeah, that's him.
Well, maybe the Corvette story is fake news.
It's very possible. I don't know. I don't know that much about this specific Corvette. He might have had one because he was just expected to have one. But I'd like to know more about it before I would really settle in and say it. I would say, yeah, he may have had it. He may have drove it around because that's what he was expected to do. But it wasn't really Neil.
You got another phone call. Can you stick around for that?
Sure.
Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Yeah, this is John from Santa Paula.
Okay.
I'm a good friend of Michelle's. I've known her a long time. And actually, a few years ago, when they had the 25th anniversary of the moon landing, we did a show up in Santa Barbara at the Carpalis Manuscript Museum, and Michelle was one of three talkers that I had come by. I had somebody from JPL, and I had Mitchell Clapp from Pioneer Rocket Plane come in. And Michelle gave an amazing presentation, so I recommend it highly if anybody gets a chance.
Thank you.
And she basically gave me, supplied me with a lot of information on, you know, to do an accurate X-15 model. And I'm really, I'm trying to track down what happened to the mock-up that was used in the movie. And I've called up to, George Welch up at the, Edwards Air Force Base Museum, the Flight Test Center Museum. And he doesn't know where it is, and I was just really curious and kind of kicking myself because I wish I had known about it, because she supplied me with great information, and I think she would say my model's probably up to par.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think and with relation to the full-scale mock-up, I have a feeling it may no longer exist. Why I say this is because of the way that the shots were done, the point of view shots when you're looking back along the X-15 or forward along the X-15. I've seen pictures of this on the soundstage, and I have a feeling that those were done with the mock-up. And what they did was they actually cut the mock-up up so that they have like the rear two-thirds of the X-15, basically from the wings back, and they mounted the camera rig on this pointing back along the wings or out over the wings, and then seeing this big cyclorama image that's behind it. And then the same kind of thing with the forward cockpit, where they had the camera rig behind the cockpit shooting right along the side. And so I got a feeling that that's the same cockpit. I don't know that for sure, but I think that's the same thing, and they may have just cut it up to do those effect shots in the soundstage. So we may never get to see that, unfortunately, because I'd love to see a really good, high-quality X-15 mock-up out there.
Well, yeah, I'd love to see it, too. I'd be willing to bet you're right, because from my limited experience doing stuff like that, I think that that's what they would do to save money. And, you know, cutting up a mock-up that they probably built quickly out of wood would be the best way to go.
Well, they could have sold it if they wanted money. That there'd be no shortage of buyers for the damn thing.
When
they were out at Edwards and they shot that landing sequence on the lake bed out there, they were there for one day. That was
right.
Done in one day. That they left themselves no margin for error or anything. So it was done very quickly. And again, it shows in the movie because there's literally only seconds of that shot.
Right, right. Well, what I was going to say, the earlier caller was saying that the younger generation would be inspired by this. And I think it's true because during the 25th anniversary we had, it was around the time of Apollo 13, and this was the first round of space startups. And everybody was saying, oh, we can do this, we can do this, we can get there, but we all need $100 million. And I think the only company that made it through was Bigelow.
Yeah.
Not sure. But now these days, with what Musk is doing, and, you know, I'm seeing younger people that are interested, because I'm wearing my NASA shirt all the time, and people will stop me and talk. Say, oh, yeah, did you see this? And, you know, we'll get to talking. So I think I'm hoping that the same thing will happen. And definitely Michelle's book needs to be made into a series. It's got to be picked up by Netflix, somebody. Somebody's got to do it, because it would make a fantastic story. And, you know, hopefully it'll happen.
Okay.
Keep our fingers crossed. I appreciate that, John.
And, oh, yeah.
Just to throw it out in context for the listeners and stuff, that John is probably the best aerospace model builder there is out there anywhere. He has just done some amazing stuff. He's got things in the Smithsonian. I mentioned earlier I've got my 4-foot X-15 model here that he did the major restoration on that. It's an actual original model from the 1960s that got busted up. And without him, it would not be what it is today. So thank you, John.
Thank you for being
a great friend.
John, do you sell your models? Do you have a website?
Yes, I do, but I don't have a website because these are, let's see, how do I put this? My own company and did work mainly for NASA, and it was just word of mouth, because the quality was good, and it was in the days where the first project they worked on was the X-33, and they didn't have blueprints, they gave me the CAD file. So I had to teach myself that and do, basically something use either CNC mills or rapid prototyping to get the model done.
Okay.
And that was kind of leading edge for model makers back then, but anyway, what I was going to say was in 2005 I became disabled, so I kind of just do it as a hobby now. And it only took me, I think I had Michelle's model for about, I don't know how many, 10 years maybe to restore?
Maybe not quite that long. A little while, yeah.
But
it was worth it.
It came out pretty nice. I'm happy with it. I finally, when I finally have modeled the entire thing in 3D, I was able to get the parts printed and correct the kind of, funny looking ones that she had. So I hopefully they're accurate.
Okay, I want to thank you for getting in and calling us
tonight.
And good talk. Call us again sometime, please.
Yes.
Thank you, John.
Take care.
Bye.
Michelle, any closing comments? Anything you'd like to leave us with?
Oh, boy. Well, as I say, I hope any of the people local to Southern California will come out at, to the Torrance Western Museum of Flight and join us on Saturday. It is a really, really wonderful museum, really worth the trip just for the museum. And hopefully you'll get a cool thing with the talk on top of it and get to meet the X-15 guys. As I say, I think the movie is probably still worth going to see, but maybe take it a little bit with a grain of salt. I love hearing both positive and negative comments about it. And maybe one of these days, one of the things would be nice to open up the discussion a little bit more without having to worry about spoilers and stuff, and we can get into some specific things. And I think it'd be a lot of fun.
Well, the truth is, if you don't know the story and
yeah.
what happens in the ending, then you deserve to be spoiled.
There you go.
I mean, as I said, you probably don't know the personal stuff and maybe some of the intricate stories that are in it. But I think, at least in my audience, people know that he flew an X-15 and what that was. You've been on the show 3 or 4 times talking about it, but so have a few others. And they know he was the first man to walk on the moon and not on a soundstage, and about the Apollo program and all of that. Buzz has been on the show several times. So it's really hard to have a spoiler unless saying something about, like, throwing the bracelet into the crater is a spoiler for someone or something like that.
Right.
So if I went to the moon, I'd be bringing souvenirs back. For my kids and my dog. I'd bring some lunar rocks back and have it made into a collar for her.
There you go.
You know, gee, I couldn't wait. So or mold it into a bone or something.
So
that is kind of an emotionless, cold approach to something.
I wish they had added more humor to it. There is absolutely zero humor in this movie. And again, I know that Neil did have a sense of humor, and I wish they'd found some of the things to talk about with that.
So there's a rumor, tell me if this is true, where Buzz and Neil did a little wine-toasting religious ceremony on the surface of the moon. What do you have to say about that? I'm sure you're aware of the story.
Well, yes, we're definitely aware of it. It did happen with Buzz. I'm sorry, Buzz was Catholic at the time. I don't know if he still is. I believe he still is, but he took communion on the moon. From Neil's perspective, Neil had nothing to do with that, and was actually a little pissed off at Buzz that he did it without saying anything. My understanding of that incident was that Neil is like, "What the heck are you doing?" You know? So, yeah, Neil definitely did not partake at all.
Interesting. When I first heard that years and years and years ago, I mean, we're going back a long, long time. It was on the Art Bell Show, and this was about there being Masons, and this was all part of the secret vault to control the moon and the aliens and everything else. That's the first introduction I had to that story.
That's the thing I got to say I really loved about Jim Hansen's book, is the fact that he took so many of these rumors and myths, and he told what those things were, the rumors and myths. He said, this is the story. And then he sat down and he said, this is what actually happened. Because so many people take those rumors and myths and say, oh, well, that's what occurred, and then it gets in there. So it's part of the lexicon, and everybody believes it happens because it never gets disputed. And I really, really love Jim's writing for actually going in there and doing the research and saying, no, this is the reality of what happened. I mean, it's the kind of thing I'll throw in there real quick is Milt Thompson, okay, great X-15 pilot, wonderful man. They have it in his official NASA biography that he was a fighter pilot in World War II. He wasn't. He was in pilot training at the time that World War II ended, so he was never in combat. And yet it's been perpetuated down through the ages at NASA that he was a World War II fighter pilot. Didn't happen. And even NASA gets hit wrong. So you really got to go out there and look for this stuff. It's what happened when I talked to Neil. I'm standing there or sitting there with Neil and saying, well, can you explain this to me or explain that to me? And it's like, well, I can give you some a little bit, but you need to go and look at the documentation because that's where you're going to find the facts. I could sit there and tell you what I might remember, but it may not be the correct thing because our memories do change over time. That's why he really relied on documentation. It's one of the reasons he didn't like to speak in public. It's like the old joke about Star Trek, you know, going up to William Shatner. Well, tell me the combination in episode 44 of your personal safe. You know,
yeah, right.
This is ridiculous. You know, it's absolutely ridiculous.
Well, listen, you know, we'll have to talk, but certainly before the movie is made on your book. So.
Oh, well, thank you. Yes. If anybody out there is interested, please give me a holler. We'd be glad to work with you.
And we'll give it a lot of publicity on the space show. It's a story that needs to be told on the screen. So.
Well, thank you very much. I hope it does happen someday. These guys need to have their story told.
Absolutely.
This is the biggest honor of my life was to tell the story of the X-15.
And
these guys are amazing.
And you need to be part of it because if you're part of it, it's not going to be like First Man. So
maybe this time I'll get a consultant credit on the credit.
And maybe you'll get a fee for it, too. What do you think?
Well, there you go. I like that, too.
Michelle, we'll talk to you soon, and thank you very much for being here. When I get it archived in the morning, I'll send all the information to you.
Okay. Thank you so much, David, and thank you to all your listeners who called and wrote in and just the people out there listening. It's really great to be on here. Thanks so much.
Great show. Listeners, thank you for your calls and your emails, and on behalf of Michelle and myself and the First Man, thank you for listening to tonight's Space Show. Keep looking up. Goodbye from the Space Show.